Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This week, children under 5 years old began to get their first COVID-19 vaccines, a milestone in the pandemic. Here's Surgeon General Vivek Murthy speaking on MSNBC yesterday.
This is a really big moment in our fight against COVID, and especially for parents like me who've got kids under five and who've been waiting for an opportunity to protect their children. We now have vaccines available for every age group 6 months and older in the United States. And what that means is that we know these vaccines are particularly effective at protecting against the worst outcomes of COVID, hospitalization and death. And that's why this is such a big deal.
A big deal and a reminder that more than 2 years in, the pandemic is not over. Now, Omicron subvariants are being detected. A growing number of people are coming down with COVID two or three times, while others continue to struggle with long COVID. So today, On Point, we'll talk about what we now know about COVID-19 and what we can expect as the pandemic evolves. Listeners, we want to hear from you during this hour. Do you have any questions about any of the recent COVID news that you've been hearing about? Do you have any experiences that you want to share regarding experiencing a reinfection or having to wait for vaccines to become available for your youngest children? Join the conversation by leaving us your comments on social media. We are at On Point Radio on Facebook and Twitter. And to help us address these questions is Cody Meissner. He's Chief of Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at Tufts Children's Hospital. He's also a member of the FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, also known as VRBPAC. Dr. Meissner, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Kim. It's my pleasure to be here with you today.
So as we're hearing about all of these new subvariants, first, I just want to ask, with everything, ongoing vaccinations, long COVID, the mutation of the virus, is this the new normal? Is COVID here to stay?
I think there will be SARS-CoV-2 or the cause of COVID-19 will be around for the foreseeable future. I think that this is a coronavirus that's very capable of eluding our immunity. And I think it will become increasingly persistent, although my thoughts are that this will become less and less virulent, and it will become more contagious, and it will probably develop a seasonal pattern as other coronaviruses do.
So I want to start off with this news about vaccines being now available to children under five. So far, it seems that we've learned that the youngest children have not been the biggest spreaders of COVID-19. Why is it so important for children to get this vaccine?
That's a very important point, Kim, that you're making here. And I think that, first of all, it's important to recognize that this is an 18-month anniversary of the availability of messenger RNAs. They first became available in the middle of December 2020, and these are absolutely remarkable vaccines that are amazingly safe and effective. And every adult should avail herself or himself of this vaccine. Now, the issue is that this virus is going to continue to mutate. All viruses, particularly the so-called RNA viruses, mutate, and they become less sensitive to the immune response that we have built up either from the vaccine or from previous infections. And I think this is what's going to transpire with SARS-CoV-2. There will be minor mutations that will continue to occur, and we may have to tweak the vaccines in order to provide optimal protection. But we don't know that yet, I think, and we may get into this in a little bit. But right now, the vaccines that we have appear to be quite effective at preventing illness in adults and in children.
So Amy Baker spoke during an FDA open hearing session last week. She shared her support for vaccines for children under five, a decision she based on the challenges she faced while waiting for them to become available.
Imagine working a job from home while your spouse works their job from home and caring for your toddler, eventually also a newborn, without any help because daycare is not safe. Imagine after doing that for a year and a half, your spouse being required to go back into the workplace and you still don't have a COVID-safe and affordable daycare option, so you become yet another woman forced to leave the workplace to protect your kids, also knowing that some parents won't have this option to keep their kids safe. Imagine preparing to give birth and anticipating it not only with excitement and anxiety of giving birth, but with an immense fear of who will be watching your almost two-year-old. And if you end up testing positive prior to delivery, your spouse won't be able to join you if you need a C-section. I don't have to imagine that was all my life last year alone.
So, I mean, she clearly is in support of this vaccine, but there are probably also parents that just want to have more information before they have their very young children, their babies, receive yet another vaccine. What do you say to those parents who are unsure or maybe or have some trepidation about vaccinating their very young children?
Yes. And Kim, I have great sympathy for that mother. At the VRBPAC meetings, we always have a public session, and people can call in and tell us their stories and their feelings. And they are always quite moving. It's very difficult to listen to a story such as the one that we just heard with an option that it may be possible to intervene. But let me make a couple of points. I think it's very important to keep this particular disease in perspective. And what I mean by that is we've learned a number of factors about this coronavirus since the pandemic began. The first case was in January of 2020. And one of the things we've learned is that this is primarily a disease that causes severe illness in adults. 96% of the more than 1 million deaths that have occurred in the United States since the onset have occurred in individuals over 40 years of age. So that means approximately 4% have occurred in individuals under 40 years of age. And in fact, 0.1% of the deaths have occurred in individuals under 18 years of age. Now, any death is obviously a very significant complication and result. No question about that. But I think what people also realize is this is a disease of the adults. It's much less of a severe disease in children. And we do know that there are complications that can be associated with the messenger RNA vaccines, these remarkably effective messenger RNA vaccines in adolescents, more common in males than in females. But still, it occurs in both sexes. And we don't know very much about that risk in young children yet. I think it was a very appropriate decision by the FDA, and I, in fact, voted for authorization, meaning that this is still an experimental vaccine. It's not an authorized or licensed vaccine in this age group. I think it's important that this vaccine be available, particularly for children who have recognized risk factors such as obesity or diabetes or leukemias, for example. And I think this vaccine for children through 4 years of age, 6 months through 4 years of age, should be available for parents like the parent we just heard on your quotation. The only point I would say is that severe disease, including hospitalization, is extremely rare in children. And I think that people in many situations have become so alarmed and so distressed about this vaccine in young children that they have not been willing to send them to daycare or play dates with, with their friends. And I think that the data that we've been seeing suggests that that's really not a very big risk at all. So
I want to ask you also, we've, as you pointed out, these subvariants are becoming more transmissible, although the people experiencing them are experiencing less severe effects of that. And just a minute before we go to our break, what does that mean? Does that mean that people, it is okay for people to let their guard down, as it seems a lot of folks are doing?
Well, remember, the vaccine is made from the original viral isolate that came from Wuhan. And that's what's used in all of the vaccines that are available around the world right now. And the virus has mutated a great deal since that original strain. But it's important to remember that the vaccines are still very effective at preventing severe illness. The vaccines will not prevent infection. And that's why the concept of herd immunity that people used to talk about so much at the start of this pandemic is probably not a real phenomenon as it pertains to SARS-CoV-2.
Okay, we're discussing what we now know about COVID-19 and what they're teaching us about the next phase of this pandemic. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking today about the latest news around COVID-19, from vaccines for children under five to COVID reinfections and long COVID. Dr. Cody Meissner is with us. He's Chief of Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at Tufts Children's Hospital. And joining us now is Akiko Iwasaki. She's Professor of Immunobiology and Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology at Yale. She's also a co-lead investigator of the Yale COVID-19 Recovery Study. Akiko, it's good to have you.
Thank you for having me, Kimberly.
So I want to talk to you about long COVID, but first let's start with the subject I was talking to Cody about, which is the vaccination of children under five. In what way, if at all, do concerns about long COVID factor into the decision to make vaccines available to very young kids?
So there are many reasons why we should be vaccinating young children. One is that, you know, even though the death rates from getting the COVID is much lower, as Dr. Meissner said, there are other complications that children can develop from getting the SARS-CoV-2 virus, such as long COVID and multisystem inflammatory syndrome that happens in rare cases, but could be quite severe. And so these are, you know, some of the other reasons why parents should be thinking about getting their children vaccinated.
So let's talk about long COVID. Just anecdotally, I know some folks who initially had very mild symptoms when they became infected with COVID-19, but subsequently have been having a lot of trouble, symptoms that last for months or more. Is that still talk a little bit about what we know about that, the fact that the virus seems to be less severe in people who are vaccinated doesn't necessarily mean that long COVID isn't a concern.
That's absolutely right. So the long COVID, which is a condition that can happen in between 10 to 30% of the people who get the initial COVID infection, can happen even after a mild or sometimes even asymptomatic infection that can turn into these long-term problems. And severe infection in people who are hospitalized with COVID have even a higher rate of developing long COVID. So this is a serious problem that's happening in parallel to acute COVID disease throughout the world.
So I also, what do we know? Have we learned more about long COVID? I mean, I know it's a concern for me, for example. I've never, to my knowledge, had COVID-19, but the reason that I'm still masking and taking precautions is that I don't want to catch it, primarily because I don't want to get long COVID. In the 2+ years that we've been dealing with this virus now, have we learned about what causes that or what the even longer term effects are?
Right. So the long COVID, originally was thought to be a mysterious disease that's happening in a subset of people. But it turns out that there are multiple other viral and bacterial infections that can lead to similar consequences. For instance, Ebola and original SARS virus and EBV, Epstein-Barr virus infection. These types of viral infection could lead to long-term consequences, sort of like the long COVID. And so learning from previous research done on these types of, chronic fatigue syndrome-like consequences of other infections are helping the researchers currently working on long COVID. The long COVID itself, we are studying this disease as well as many others, and could be happening because of several different reasons. One is that people who acquire persistent virus infection or remnants of viral infection that could trigger long-term diseases consequences. The other possibility is that people develop autoimmune diseases as a result of an infection. Other types of theories include the endogenous viruses that we carry in our body that become reactivated as a result of the COVID infection and are causing some symptoms. And also damage caused by the virus infection or the host immune response to the virus can be leading to unrepaired tissue damage that could be triggering these long-term symptoms.
So, Cody, I want to talk about reinfections. They seemed very rare in the first year of this pandemic, but now they seem to be becoming increasingly more common, even in people who are vaccinated. Why is that happening?
Thank you, Kim. And I just want to comment that Dr. Iwasaki has made a number of contributions to our understanding of persistent symptoms after acute infections. And one that I'm also quite interested in is in Lyme disease. And here there's clearly a post-Lyme syndrome that some people develop, and it's simply not clear what is causing those symptoms. So I just want to recognize her contributions in this area and how important they are. To address your question, initially, we thought the vaccines were very effective at preventing infections. And when both Pfizer and Moderna conducted their initial trials of very large numbers, more than 30 to 40,000 subjects who were randomized, it looked as though, at least for the first few months, people did not get infected after the second dose of the messenger RNA vaccines. But as time has gone by, we've come to realize that, in fact, part of the immune response to the vaccine wanes. And that part is what we talk about as antibodies. And those antibodies seem to decline below a level that will protect a person from becoming infected. They will still prevent a person from getting sick and having to go to the hospital in most cases. And that's probably because of another part of the immune response, the so-called T-cell immune response, that probably persists. And that's what continues to protect people from severe disease. But as time goes by, there is waning immunity in terms of the antibodies. There are also mutations that occur in the virus, making them less sensitive to the antibodies that were made after the infection or the vaccine. And so they still can become infected, and they can still spread the virus to people around them who are susceptible to the infection. And I think we've learned this most recently from Dr. Tony Fauci, who had his primary series. Then my understanding is he had two boosters, and yet he still became infected. He wasn't very sick, but he was still worried about transmitting the virus to the president and to others, and so he appropriately isolated himself. But I think we're learning that this is likely what's going to happen as we move forward into this pandemic.
I just want to bring in a comment from one of our listeners on Facebook who said there was a study indicating that even vaccinated people are at increased risk for conditions like type 2 diabetes after infection. So is that risk increase cumulative when you are reinfected? Am I just accumulating long-term risk every time I'm exposed to other people at work or elsewhere? Akiko, what do you say to that?
Yes. So for the most part, people who are getting reinfected are not getting more severe disease from their original infection because of the accumulating immune responses that one can build against this virus to prevent severe consequences. However, there is a study that is in a preprint that came out of the Veterans Affairs group by Dr. Al-Ali that shows that reinfection in that group of people does increase risk for all-cause mortality as well as.
Cody, you want to, I think we temporarily lost Akiko. Yes. Do you want to address that?
Yes, and I think she's referring to a recent paper in Nature, which has shown that people who are vaccinated still can experience the same spectrum of symptoms that are associated with so-called long COVID infection. That is, the infection may be relatively mild in a vaccinated person, but that person is still at risk of developing long COVID. It's probably going to be a lower risk than in someone who's not vaccinated. But I think this virus is so devious that it's going to be very hard to eliminate all of these complications. And in response to the question, Kim, that was just asked, I think, again, we don't fully understand the relationship between SARS-CoV-2 infection and the development of diabetes mellitus. We do know that people with diabetes tend to have more severe disease. We also know that there are people who develop diabetes after infection by this coronavirus. It may very well be that it's immune mediated, just as we have heard from Dr. Iwasaki. That is, the response to the virus may somehow damage some of the cells in the pancreas that are responsible for producing insulin. It's a very important issue, but very, very complicated. And I don't think we can answer exactly what's happening right now.
Another listener writes on Facebook, with long COVID symptoms that are debilitating, I've had an intensely itchy rash all over my body for 5 months. Where can one find doctors who will acknowledge and treat us? Akiko, I think that you are back. Talk about what physicians need to be doing, need to be looking out for to better treat people who are suffering the long-term effects of COVID-19.
Yeah, this is a an ongoing issue that because we're dealing with this relatively new condition, the physicians are not yet educated as to, you know, how to diagnose patients with long COVID and how to provide proper treatment. Actually, we don't really have a proper treatment that can help long COVID patients at the root cause. So what we're dealing with is just symptomatic treatment of whatever they're having, whether it be skin rash or fatigue or post-exertional malaise or other issues. So yeah, physician education and having centers of excellence to treat long COVID patients is a top priority right now.
So when it comes to reinfections, even in people who have been vaccinated, who have received their boosters, is there something else that we should be doing? I mean, we've seen most of the COVID mitigation measures being lifted in most places. Masking requirements, for example, distancing requirements, those are being lifted. But with reinfections happening, what should our listeners be doing to best protect themselves, given that there are continued risks like long COVID, Cody?
Well, I would say that people need to, we all need to think differently about risk. Risk is something that we encounter every day. When you get in a car and drive to work, you're accepting the risk that you could get into an automobile accident. And I think we have to understand that the risk of SARS-CoV-2 is unlikely to go away. And we have to learn to accept the fact that in the vast majority of people, because the CDC now tells us that 95%, based on their surveys from commercial laboratories, have immunity, have antibody to this virus. And I think if a person is appropriately vaccinated for age and has received the primary series and the recommended booster, then the likelihood of very severe disease is very low. It's certainly not zero. I'm the first. But we also have to learn to open up a little bit. I think we've learned that, for example, in March of 2020, every school was closed in the United States from kindergarten through 12th grade. Now, the consequences of that, I think we're finding now, are enormous. And the harm that came from that may far exceed any benefit in protecting those children. So I think we have to kind of have a reset in terms of how we think about risk. We're not going to be able to avoid every infection. You can wear an N95 mask and you will still run a risk of becoming infected. And I think we need to rethink about this and maybe develop a slightly more rational approach to how we've got this.
Yeah. Akiko, what do we know about other viruses? I mean, in 2020, it seemed that the incidence of flu, for example, just plummeted because we were all indoors. But we're seeing the flu and colds and other coronaviruses rise now. Why is that happening?
Well, these viruses are, you know, seasonal and they're circulating and they're mutating just like the SARS-CoV-2 is. And so, you know, if you've been not vaccinated against flu and you haven't been exposed to any flu antigens, then your immune response to the flu virus also wanes over time. So, and the fact that the flu virus changes every year. And so, you know, this just means that one needs to keep up with the vaccines for other viruses if they're available, and just, you know, be cautious and just to use Dr. Meissner's, you know, analogy for driving a car. You always put your seatbelt on, you know, just to prevent severe consequences of an accident. And similarly, you can do other measures with viruses, such as wearing masks or washing hands or just, you know, doing the things that you can do to prevent exposure to viruses.
So we are discussing what we know now about COVID-19 and what we are still learning as the next phase of this pandemic approaches. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking today about the latest news around the COVID-19 pandemic, from vaccines for children under 5 to COVID reinfections and long COVID. Dr. Cody Meissner joins us. He's chief of Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at Tufts Children's Hospital. Professor Akiko Iwasaki is also with us. She's professor of immunobiology and molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at Yale. So I want to start off playing some sound from Caroline Bishop. She spoke during an FDA open public hearing session last week. She shared her fear that too many people have been acting like the pandemic is already over.
The most heartbreaking part of this realization has been that people that I love and respect have embraced the idea that COVID is over. I had to beg my parents to wear masks on the plane before they saw my daughter. My brother and sister-in-law refused to be vaccinated, so we've had to keep her away from her aunt, uncle, and cousins. Even medical experts that I respect decided this spring that it was more convenient to cater to the whims of those who have decided to move on than to protect these little lives.
So we talked a little bit about how this pandemic is not over, but at the same time, we have to learn to live with the current state of COVID-19 as well. But a question that I have is, in 2020 and 2021, there was a lot of testing happening, there was a lot of contact tracing, and that was giving us data that we needed to better understand what's happening. I'm not sure people are testing or submitting that data the same way they used to. Akiko, how does that affect what we are learning and what we are continuing to understand about COVID-19?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that in the beginning of the pandemic, we were doing a lot more testing and survey and reporting of cases and contact tracing and informing others about infection and so on. But with the rise of the Omicron variant being so transmissible and so prevalent, and the fact that we now have rapid antigen tests that people can do at home, the reporting and the collection of data and the surveillance of the virus is becoming less accurate or, you know, less performed in the country. So we are losing some data as to, you know, how many people are actually infected and how many people are reinfected and how many people are getting long COVID from each of these variants as we go into this new phase of people not testing through the PCR testing.
And what does that mean for research, Cody? Do you think that
the professional that you still have all of the information you need to make decisions that are needed to be made and to stay on top of treatment and other information that we need.
Yes, I would answer it this way. First of all, I'm very sympathetic to this person's anxiety, but I would tend to address it this way. Reporting the number of cases of COVID-19 or of SARS-CoV-2 infections really doesn't have much meaning, because we've learned that perhaps 50%, perhaps more than 50% of people who are infected and are capable of transmitting the virus have no symptoms whatsoever. So just finding the number of cases doesn't tell us very much that we can use in a meaningful way. What does tell us a lot is the hospitalization rate. We want very much to avoid surges in hospitalizations with people who have illness. And those numbers are way down. If you you can go to the CDC data tracker site and it will show you the number of hospital-associated patients or number of patients with a hospital, number of hospitalized patients with a COVID COVID-19 infection, and those numbers are falling very dramatically. That's what we care about, and that's what I would tell this caller. The infection is not going to go away. We're going to have to live with this infection, just as we do with the common cold, the rhinovirus, and with seasonal coronaviruses. We're just going to have to learn to live with it. So, but the pandemic has gone down. After the Delta wave, the pandemic has dramatically gone down. And it's important to loosen up the way we have to get our economy and our country going again, because the enormous price that both children and adults have paid for locking down our country is staggering and will last for more than a generation. So I would suggest that woman, if she's very concerned about herself and her parents on the airplane, yes, wear an N95 mask. Make sure they're all vaccinated. I think she said some of her relatives weren't vaccinated. That's not acceptable. But you have, again, going back to risk, there is always going to be this virus, around, and we have to learn to live with it.
What do we know, Akiko, about what more have we learned about the how long vaccinations and boosters last, for example, and how effective that immunity boost is? We know that they don't stop people from getting infected, but again, anecdotally, I know of people who are waiting, timing their boosters before they take a trip or before they visit elderly family members. Is that really the way to go, or should it be more of a regular thing that you do regardless of the time?
So the antibody responses do wane over time. And the protection will accordingly also wane over time. So it's very important to keep up with the booster doses that are recommended by the CDC. Instead of counting, how many days from the last booster you may have gotten, definitely keep up with the recommendation of the CDC and keep the booster doses up to date. And with the new variants and sub-variants that are on the rise, we cannot really expect the current vaccines to prevent infections. What we are hoping is that the current vaccine will still prevent severe disease and death. However, there are ways to approach this differently in the future. We're working on mucosal vaccines that can be delivered nasally to provide protection right at the nose and the throat. And that may prevent infection as well as transmission And those are the type of vaccines that I think we need to sort of start to think about going forward, given the rise of all these variants and subvariants and how transmissible the virus is getting.
And Cody, I want to talk to you about this nasal vaccination that does show, as Akiko said, the ability not just to prevent the worst symptoms, but also prevent infections themselves. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yes. And first, may I just comment on your last question? Next week, there is a VRBPAC meeting, and the topic of that meeting is going to be what will be the basis for deciding when we need to change the composition of these messenger RNA vaccines. It's pretty easy to change the vaccine. The difficult part is getting it into people's arms, of course. But we have to decide on what will be the threshold for saying the current generation of vaccines are not doing as well as some other vaccines might do. And how do we decide when we reach that point? It's a very tricky question, but also a very important one. And I'm sorry, can you remind me of the question you just asked? Yeah.
Yes, no, that is important. I'm glad that you brought that up. I was asking about the nasal vaccine.
Oh, yes. The nasal vaccines are an extremely exciting area because a vaccine or an infection doesn't always stimulate a maximal mucosal immunity. It's and here we're talking largely about a specific class of antibodies called IgA antibodies. But we know that the portal of entry of respiratory viruses is in fact the nasal mucosa or the lower respiratory tract. And so what we would like is to have a high concentration of antibodies that are just residing on the mucosal surfaces that would inactivate the virus before it even begins to cause disease. And this is called sterilizing immunity. And if we can get to the point where we have good mucosal vaccines, then I think it will change the whole picture. Because then we may be able to interrupt the circulation of this coronavirus. There is one intranasal vaccine that's been around for a while. It's kind of had a up and down course, but FluMist, which is a vaccine against the influenza viruses, and that's administered once a year as an intranasal vaccine. That in certain situations is quite effective. So I think the promise of topical or mucosal vaccines is tremendous.
And Akiko, you're one of the people working on the mucosal vaccines. When might something like that be available, and how do you think that may change the way we're vaccinated from here on?
There are some nasal vaccines that are already in clinical trials in different phases. And so we are waiting for the results of those studies. But we're also creating our own vaccine that hopefully can be tried in human clinical trials soon. But, you know, in terms of how we approach respiratory infections altogether, if we can develop a safe and effective mucosal vaccine, I think the way we can sort of communicate the vaccines to people are also going to be different. It's not just about preventing severe disease, but also potentially transmission can be prevented. And that means that you're doing this for the community. You're getting the nasal vaccine to prevent the spread of the virus to your neighbors, your friends, your family members. And I think that would have a very different sort of, attitude. People would have different attitude for getting such a vaccine. And also, nasal vaccines are much easier than needle vaccines to administer, and potentially this can become a self-administered vaccine one day. So I think it's definitely worth working on these kinds of new vaccine strategies.
So Akiko, should we think of COVID-19 as we move into the future of this pandemic and its endemic stages? Can we think of this as a seasonal disease, just like the flu or colds?
Eventually, this virus will become a seasonal virus, just like the common cold versions of the coronavirus. But we're still not at that stage yet. I mean, we're still dealing with lots of variants that are coming up, and it's not seasonal yet. It's coming up much quicker than, you know, every fall or winter. So I would not put our guards down quite now. We should still be doing vaccines, boosters, masking, washing hands, and, you know, all the possible things we can do to prevent getting infected with this virus.
And Cody, when might you think we reach that point where it's something that's more rudimentary, the same way we get our flu shots or get our allergy medications? We have to remember to also get our COVID boosters in a seasonal way and move on to the other side of this pandemic.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, Kim, and very difficult to answer, because so far, as we track the variants, the mutations that have taken place tend to make each new strain, and we encounter a new clade or a new subset almost every 2 or 3 months. But so far, the trend has been towards less severe disease but increased contagion. The issue is, if it were to mutate so that it was not resistant to the immune response that we currently have following administration of the vaccine, or say the virus mutated and it could attack other cell receptors other than ACE2, then we're going to have a big problem. I think we're all hopeful that that does not happen, and it would be somewhat surprising if that happened, because remember, a virus doesn't want to kill its host, because that's a dead-end host. It wants to make you sick, but it wants you to stay well enough so you go to school, you go to work, and you infect your coworkers. So I suspect that it's going to continue to mutate to a less virulent strain. But I, this virus has made us all look pretty bad. It's so hard to predict. I wouldn't want to make a guess.
And Akiko, what do you think? What do you think the chances of a more severe variant?
Yeah, I stopped guessing things because we've been proven wrong by this virus. This virus, you know, it's very ingenious. It can mutate and do a lot of different new tricks. So I'm not really counting on this virus evolving into something very mild just yet. Hopefully it will. You know, it will eventually, but I'm not sure if now is the time to think about that.
Professor Akiko Iwasaki is professor of immunobiology and molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at Yale. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Cody Meissner is chief of division of pediatric infectious disease at Tufts Children's Hospital. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to talk with you both.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.